According to the late Swiss psychiatrist Carl Gustav Jung, dreams are a gateway to the collective unconscious. Dream decoder, researcher, and explorer Judy Gardner knows all too well how dreams can tell a multidimensional story about our personal and collective reality. From our distant past to visions of the future, dreams are a vault of information that we have stored within us, our own Akashic record, and we all have access to it. We just need to figure out how to learn its language. I spoke with Judy about her quest into understanding the complexity, the beauty, and importance of dreams, how her own dreams led her on a journey to understand that science and spirituality are inextricably linked, and that our dreams are both personal and planetary and hold great meaning for the future of our species and of the world. Judy Gardner, you are what I would call the quintessential dreamer. You know, I know you said that you learned to have incredible dream recall, but it wasn't always that way. In fact, you were working in the corporate world, I think you said, and when you were there, you could barely remember your dreams. I find that interesting and curious. Why do you think that was, and what got you to begin to remember your dreams?
Well, you know, when I was in the corporate world, you know, I was in a management level position, and it was just, you know, for a very long time, it was like 25 years worth of, you know, just having to be there. And, you know, my mind was just much more involved with my working. And I'm sure, of course, I was dreaming because we all dream 25% of the time.
Sure.
But, I just wasn't remembering. It just wasn't seeping in. And then finally, when I stopped, I had moved to Copenhagen, Denmark for a short time. And during that time, I had run into, you know, a lot of personal upheaval. And I had a dream that was quite perplexing, and that led me to try to unravel my family matrix.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And when that happened, everything else just fell into place, because then the first dream I ever had was about the optic nerve, and that it was a breakthrough for humankind. And that was just such a strange dream for me to have, because I didn't have any background in the optics, the optical
sure.
system, or any science for that matter.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that was really the impetus, because you felt so driven to kind of unravel and understand that
initial
dream?
Yes, I mean, it stayed with me for a long time before I actually took a really close look at it. But when I did, I saw that not only did I have the optic nerve, but I had so many other images from having to do with the visual system that it really made me really take note. And then that was combined with dreams of light, where I was, like, not able to see. I'd
mm-hmm.
be crossing the street with a blindfold on. And I'd go to my dream doctor, and he would give me a prescription for glasses. And I'm thinking, what am I not seeing? And then I put the two together, and I had vision, and I had light, and I was not seeing the light.
Interesting. Wow.
And then that led into just an avalanche of science.
I'm sure. Well, I want to get to a term that you use. You refer to something you call the dream vault. Now, even though we may not remember our dreams on demand, they're indeed stored away, and they can be revealed or remembered when it's appropriate or necessary to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, when you talk about the fact that you know, for this 25-year period in corporate America, it's not that the dreams were lost. They were in this dream vault. How did you come up with that term, a vault? I think that's interesting.
Well, I mean, that just came up very spontaneously in the interview with Cynthia. But, I mean, as I was saying it, I was realizing that nothing is lost, that everything is imprinted.
Yeah.
It's sort of like our brains are Akashic records, so that everything is imprinted in our mind or in our brain. Nothing is forgotten. And that is, I think, what happened was that I had all those 25 years of corporate focus. All of this was probably happening. And at that time, although it's not dated in that way, since there's no calendar in Dream Heaven.
That's right.
But it was all being stored until I had time to really take a look at it. And I think that this is the way it is for many people.
Wow.
Who say they don't remember. No, a lot of people say they don't even have dreams.
That's right. I know. Yeah.
I mean, the great majority of people claim that they do not dream.
Right. No, I know. And we both know that dreams, I think by the age of 13 or so, we're dreaming an average of 4 to 6 times per night.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It is funny to hear people say that. And I say, oh, you're dreaming, you're just not recalling it. And maybe we can get into a little bit more of why people aren't recalling a little later. But I want to get to your book, Lavender. Incredibly detailed book. Although it's written in a fictional style, it's based largely on your own dream adventures. Can you get, if it's possible, to give a thumbnail sketch about such a full book? Would you be willing to do that, Judy?
Oh, sure. I think that, you know, what happened was that more and more science was coming to me in my dreams, and
mm-hmm.
these were all subjects that I had not studied. And so it was quite intriguing because I knew that this was happening for a reason. I mean, was this for my own education, or was it extending beyond that? And once I started to put it all together, which I can go into at some point, then I realized that it was not for me alone, and that I was receiving, by way of all of the science, I was receiving warnings as to what is happening with our Earth, within our Earth. And that is when I knew this took the better part of 15 years of research and connecting the dots. I knew then that it was no longer for me alone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I realized that, you know, there was just a much larger picture here, which is why I call my work Cosmic Dreaming.
Cosmic Dreaming.
Right.
In the context of Lavender, there's the protagonist who's called Penelope Peacock, correct? give us a little thumbnail, if you will, about, you know, set it up for us.
The book begins with me as myself. And then she comes in as she is starting to realize her higher self, her larger nature, and she is now beginning to transition or make a transpersonal adjustment from her personal dreams to her transpersonal dreams. And so the way she got to be Penelope, Penny rather, was, you know, they call her
mm-hmm.
Penny, was that she had had a dream where she had had she put a penny in one eye and a dime in the other. And it was sort of like they were like contact lenses. So they told me that maybe contact was being made in some form.
Uh-huh.
And then it was like one said liberty and one said, and God we trust. So the liberty, the one that said, the coin that said liberty, I put in my right eye. So for me, my dream language says that right is the future. And in God we trust, I put that one in the left eye. And that was the past. And that I always had a very strong belief in creative force.
Isn't that amazing?
So that's how Penny came into the picture. And then Peacock, her last name, was because I used to work at CBS, and the logo at CBS was the CBS eye.
Isn't that something?
And then it was like intercommunication, because I was also having dreams that were pointed to ABC and NBC. So I had the three networks, and they were all coming together, and of course the peacock has so many eyes. And that was then referring back to vision. This is how the book got to be so big, because everything was connecting and connecting.
Sure, I can see it, yes.
And so that's when Penelope Peacock was born.
Was born and took on a life of her own, I'm sure.
Oh, I mean, it just changed my life in ways that are unimaginable even today.
I wouldn't be surprised if Penelope or Penny is walking around somewhere today. And I say that somewhat facetiously, but I've got to tell you, this could take us in a whole other direction, Judy, in terms of, you know, you may have heard of the book Conjuring Up Philip. Now, we're getting into a little paranormal here, but, you know, you often wonder whether, you know, especially when an individual, and a mad, quote-unquote, imaginary individual is created with such distinction that on some level that energy does not become manifest somewhere. I want to maybe, this was unanticipated, but maybe go there a little bit later. But I think this is amazing, but I think what's even, without you even going through the whole book, is you obviously have a keen sense and a proclivity for understanding the rich metaphorical value, not just value, but understanding, distilling the metaphor in dreams. I mean, the way you took the coins, one in one eye, one in the other, one representing left, one right, In God We Trust, liberty, is just really, that's a talent. And putting it all together in the way that you did. So, wow, we're just 10 minutes.
You know, it's, I would just like to mention something about Conjuring Up Philip. I mean, I haven't read it, but I know the story.
Yeah.
Is that I was born, and this is in the book, I was born 3 months premature.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a photograph in the book of me and then another me.
Another.
And I spent years having this photograph examined to see if it might have been a double image. I later learned that there were twins on the maternal side of my family. And many people felt that that was a spirit, the second image. I wish I could tell you which pages it's on.
Oh, I'm going to look for it.
Right, but, I mean, that was the beginning of my exploration into who is this other little person. And, of course, this other little person was appearing in many, many dreams.
Sure.
As well as in that photograph. Then I learned about something called the vanishing twin syndrome.
Yep, I've heard of it.
Where one is then absorbed back into the placenta.
That's right.
So I thought I'd just inject that.
That's a very important point. Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
I'm just so tempted to go off the page here because we could take this in so many different directions. But I think we'll probably wind back into sort of the paranormal or parapsychological aspects that are associated with all these things that we're talking about. But let's stick with lavender for, well, we'll be talking about it throughout. But, you know, on the one hand, lavender sounds like an adventure beyond imagination that we could liken to adventures of Alice in Wonderland with a proverbial rabbit hole and all. And again, I get the feeling that this book, it is, it's a comprehensive study in cosmic truths, science and spirit, not seen as separate, but undifferentiated and indistinguishable, right?
That's exactly right. That was, I think, one of the, you know, this is a multi-layered book, and it has many, many different applications and many purposes, but one of them was to the marriage, the bridging of science and spirituality, because it was all coming, I believe, through spirit, through the collective unconscious, and the subject matter was science.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think, I don't know, maybe this is a naive question, but why do you think, that there's been such a gap between, or I guess a gap would be the right word, between science and spirit, science and spirituality? What happened?
I don't know. I mean, it really, you know, if you go all the way back, I mean, two of my mentors were from the second century, and they certainly understood both sides, and somehow over the centuries we have deviated, and science, you know, the problem, I think, honestly, Alexis, is that we can't quantify spirit.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Not yet.
Not yet. We don't have the instruments to measure it as yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're getting close. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, we can get into that, but I think that because it's not measurable at the moment, then science just doesn't know what to do with it.
Mm, that's a good
because
point.
Because everything has to be quantified.
Everything has to be quantified. I hope we get beyond that stage. You know, there's a quote by a woman that I haven't heard of for quite some time named Dana Zohar. She's a physicist and philosopher.
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
And I'll never forget, she was, I think she was featured in a documentary on life after death. And, you know, really just kind of talking about the same thing, that science, you know, denies experience because it does not have the instruments of the moment to measure it. And I remember that quote to this day. I think the documentary came out in the, I don't know, late, maybe mid-90s.
Yes.
And I remember saying to myself even then, I don't know that it will ever be quantifiable, but, you know, when are we going to get to the point where quantifiable by the means that we're looking for is not necessary? That science is going to have to get their hands in it and really become experiencers of phenomena. And that's your instrument, really.
Exactly.
So,
and that's what it is. It's experiential.
It's experiential.
Oh, so, you know, I mean, I was just really thrilled to learn that a paper that I had written was accepted by the University of Gdansk, and that is going to be published as part of a collective volume on dreams.
Oh,
it's available to all of academia, and to me that was just, you know, really mind-boggling because, you know, there's so many scientists involved in academia.
I think they're finally relenting, Judy. Maybe
yeah,
they're finally relenting.
I mean, I think that, you know, some of the ropes have been loosened a little bit, and they're starting to look at, well, maybe there really is something to this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's hard to deny anymore. We have so many wonderful people like yourself, like Dr. Larry Dossey, whom I interviewed not so long ago, that are just and perfectly, you know, accredited physicians and physicists that are, you cannot deny the data. It's there. So maybe they are finally relenting and caving into the new paradigm versus hanging on to the old. Wow. Well, you know, you just did a recent interview with our mutual colleague, Cynthia Sue Larson. I want to quote something that you said, Judy.
Sure.
You said, quote, "The writing process for writing this book entailed years of untangling an intricate web of fragments and coded images." We've touched upon this before, but it bears repeating. "Coded images authenticated by intensive research, synchronous experiences, electronic anomalies," which I'd like to have you comment on, "and powerful intuitive flashes," end quote. Now, I know you've become quite skilled at decoding the symbols, archetypes, and metaphor of dreams, but something that you mentioned, electronic anomalies, what is that?
Well, you know, what happened the first time I had the experience was that I was writing about my aunt who is deceased. And I had closed that file to go onto a website, which was an astronomy website. And when I went back to where I was writing, there was about 17 characters, or let's say a line and a half of type, that had changed to Greek lettering.
Okay.
And it was just perplexing. And I thought, oh, this must be some sort of a computer blip. I didn't think anything of it. But I was curious, so I scrolled a little forward. Just, you know, greedy creatures that we are. I scrolled a little forward to see if there was more. And there wasn't. And when I went back, this is important, when I went back, it was gone. And then I had such a rush of feeling and loss, and oh my God, no one is ever going to believe that I saw this. And so, you know, I turned the whole computer off. I turned it back on, and then it was back. And I made a hard copy as fast as I could.
Oh, good.
I tried to. That's a story in and of itself. But anyway, I tried to copy and paste it to another document. I couldn't do that. And that was the beginning of the Greek, what I call implantations. And that line of 17 characters was all in code. I have consulted with a number of Greek Orthodox priests. I have talk to Byzantinists, and they all come up with the same thing, that it is in code. The one thing that I've been able to extrapolate from that is that there are five omegas in the 17.
Five omegas, and that can be concerning to some because omega denotes end, the last letter, right?
Yes, the beginning and the end.
And the beginning and the end, that's absolutely right.
And then there are some theta, which is in Greek, theos, which is God.
Shall I ask now what your surmise as to what the message is or was?
In that line? Oh, I'm still working on it.
You're still working on it?
Oh, yes.
Do you have a sense, Judy? Do you have an intuitive sense as to what it's saying? Even just without having any, you know, you're still in the process, but do you have a feeling?
Well, I have a feeling. I mean, it's all from what I've been able to glean so far is that it seems to be all scientific and really based in physics. But I'm really going out on a limb with that because I haven't thoroughly investigated it.
Yeah. That's powerful.
But that was anyway, so you asked about the electronic anomalies. That is the way it began. And then I started to get more grief, but in very relevant places to what I was working on. So it was as though, you know, I had like this little ghostwriter helping me out.
Sure.
So you know, I would be talking about past life, and, you know, my font is always black, and then it would change to gray.
Oh, my goodness.
Or I'd be writing about the Earth, and then on certain passages that were significant, it would change to green.
To green.
And then in one part, I was talking about magic, about the illusion of Madison Avenue, which is where I worked, and how I was giving up that illusion to pursue something more realistic and meaningful. And as I was typing that, it changed from black to pale blue and then to lavender. And then I learned that lavender is called blue magic, and it is ruled by Mercury, the great communicator.
The great communicator. And so is that really, is that where you got the name of the book from?
No.
It isn't?
No, lavender, oh, well, on the face of it, lavender is, you know, this beautiful fragrance in a beautiful place. I think of Provence.
Yes.
In France. I think of the healing qualities of lavender and how it's been with us through the centuries. But once I began to get into the decoding of symbols, I realized that our spirits do indulge in wordplay. I mean, they just love to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out to be lava under.
Ah, I see.
Which brings it all into sort of a geological focus.
Right. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. There's so much. We're going to have everyone going out and just sort of decoding everything.
Well, the decoding, I mean, it's just, I do have something on my website. It's like a little six-step process that tells people sort of, if they want to be a dream detective, I call it a little primer,
uh-huh.
A dream detective. Because they can go to this place on my website.
We're going to make sure to have your website linked up, and I'm going to have you give it to us at the end of the show. Well, you know what? Give it to us now. Tell us the website.
Okay, the website is www.cosmicdreaming.com.
Cosmicdreaming.com, okay.
Right, and then they'll go to a link that says lavender.
Okay.
And there'll be a drop-down menu, and that says kaleidoscopic vision.
Kaleidoscopic vision. Got it. So people can take a glance while they're listening if you like. Of course, we want you to hear what Judy is saying, but you'll have an opportunity to go there and become a dream decoder, investigator. Great.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just the basics, but it's enough to get started with.
Sure, yeah. I think it is so amazing, and I knew that you and I, Judy, were connected at the heartstrings because of our approach to looking at the physical world. You know, I talk about a lot in my book about synchronicity and how the universe speaks through metaphor. And the more you notice it or decide to commit to noticing it, the more you will speak its language. You obviously have a natural affinity for that. And it's a beautiful thing, I think, once you realize that the universe can use all matter of physical, you know, all matter of physicality to convey messages. And it's all really, everything that we're looking at has some sort of message implicit in it. But there's some people that I just think have a knack for understanding that intuitively and moreover knowing how to decode. And you obviously have that gift. So that's a wonderful thing. Well, let's continue down the road of dreams. You know, there's so many terms that you brought up that really piqued my interest. One of them is called bidirectional dreaming. I'd like you to talk about what that is.
Yes, that's one of my favorite subjects because through this whole experience, I learned that we are dreaming not only in the present, but we are looking backward. I had dreams of things that happened way before I was ever born, and we're also looking forward. And then, concurrently, we are dreaming both for our personal issues and for global issues.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going from inside outside and from past to present to future. Well, past, let's say, to future, when it's actually all happening at one time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that is the bidirectional dreaming, and I don't know if you want me to say a little more.
Please.
About that. I can give you just a few things.
Absolutely. Go for it.
Okay. On the personal, we're basically concerned with survival of self.
Sure.
And so those dreams are more emotional. They give us insights into our private lives and relationships, identity issues, and they help us to overcome shortcomings and all of that. The other, the outward, the cosmic, is where our concern for self then transcends to concern for species survival.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in my experience, was the outgrowth of my personal dreams.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're literally going in two directions simultaneously.
Simultaneously.
And yet there's somehow, what I'm sensing is that they're also mirrors of each other, and perhaps, what do I want to say? It sounds like they can not negate each other, but kind of meld into one concern, service
exactly,
to self, service to others.
Exactly, Alexis. It's a seamless whole.
Right, which is a very, one of our favorites, David Bohm.
Yes.
Seamless whole. I want to talk about that too, his
right.
Implicate order. It's just, yeah. You know, it's no wonder science is relenting. I really do sense that's what's happening because it's just way too much evidence, too much continuity of, you know, what we're talking about here. It all points back to this continuum of consciousness, whether it unfolds metaphorically, whether it unfolds literally, the fact that we're connected to it. I use the famous whirlpools in a stream that he made metaphor.
Yes, I noticed that.
I love that. I think
yeah.
That's so apropos. It's, you cannot extract the whirlpools from the stream, and yet they have identity. The stream would be that continuum of consciousness that we're all intricately linked to. So, wow. Well, let's move to bidirectional dreaming. So let's take note of that. I think that's powerful, and I think that's something really to kind of see if we can get our arms around. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's immense when you stop to think about it, but once you've experienced it, it becomes very apparent. There are certain images in the dream that will clue us into whether or not it's for personal or transpersonal.
Oh, there's certain elements in the dream that can kind of, okay.
So, you know, it's just a question of recognizing them, and that is in my little dream detective.
Sure. Well, how do archetypes play into that, Judy, in terms of, I mean, we know the archetypal model that Jung, I think, made so famous. When we dream of, for instance, teeth falling out or, you know, running around naked, things that people talk about invariably that seem to be archetypes, could we use those archetypal type dreams to be able to determine what type of dream we're having, whether it's a personal dream or
Well, we could. I mean, I can give you, I guess, one example of a classic symbol, which is water and the ocean.
Yes.
So it's the primordial tears. So you could, at first glance, you could say, I mean, this is not a person, but I think it will serve the same purpose, is that you can look at that and think, well, you know, it's your emotional life that is talking to you. But then what happened was I started to get dreams of Titanic. Mm-hmm. But I got them with such specifics, so much detail, names of people who were on the boat, incidents that occurred, some of which were not, I mean, I know it's, you know, it's very public, but I understand a lot of what I was getting was not made public. I really had to dig and dig and dig for that. And that's when I realized that the Titanic is this ship that we are all on.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, we know what its fate was.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
In terms of people, you know, my archetypes are all of these scientists, you know, historical figures of science. And that is something that I still don't totally understand. My late partner, Montague Ullman, I don't know if you know.
Yes, that was my next question, to talk about Dr. Ullman.
Oh, yes. Brilliant. Okay, well, then I'll stop.
No, please.
Well, I mean, you know, he and I had this debate for 5 years about where this was coming from, and he was very scientifically oriented, and I was very spiritually oriented. So we were really, honestly, two different sides of the same coin.
Right.
So his theories validated my experience, and my experience validated his theories. But we had this ongoing debate about where was this coming from, and I said, I think it's coming from spirit. And he would say, well, I think it's coming from the implicit order. And then he would say, but you know, you just have a scientific gene in you.
Well, that's interesting that he would say it was coming from the implicate order, because I've always looked at at David Baum's model of the implicate and explicate. Implicate, to me, is the spiritual. Explicate is when it unfolds into the physical.
Exactly. It's the waking, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, anyway, he finally decided that it was just a question of jargon.
Yeah.
And that we were, in fact, speaking of the same thing, that the implicate and the spirituality were in fact one and the same. Good. I just felt like I had won.
I love
an
it.
An incredible boxing match.
Yeah, and that what a man. I've known that name for many years.
He was wonderful. Well, he still is. He's very much around, even now.
Yeah, and I think he passed, in 2008, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, his Maimonides, I don't ever pronounce this properly, the Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn.
Maimonides.
I knew I was going to butcher it. Sorry, Dr. Ullman.
Dr. Ullman, he was, you know, really one in a million.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, he is still very much present.
Have you dreamt of him?
Oh, my goodness, yes. And then, you know, there's more work along those lines, because some of the dreams are quite personal and others are very scientific.
Wow.
So I guess I've got my work cut out.
You sure do. You sure do. You know,
it's just so amazing that we came together.
Yeah. Wow. This is just something. I'm listening to everything. You know, I've got questions about different aspects of the book and of dreams, and yet I'm hearing this common theme, Judy. Science and spirit are inextricably linked.
Yes.
And isn't it so, science and spirit are inextricably linked, just like the wave and particle are really the same. It's just different expressions of the same fundamental thing.
That's exactly right. Exactly right. I feel that Monty's smiling my only issue right now.
Oh, good. Hello.
Then why couldn't you be this agreeable?
I know. This is great. Oh, my goodness. Well, you know, I know he was so intrigued by the idea of parapsychology from a young age.
Yeah, when he was just before college.
And didn't he have sittings? I think I had read...
Yes, the Bendeloff story. I can email that to you.
I would love that.
Yeah, where they did, you know, all the table movements. And there was a discarnate spirit that came to this group of adolescents. And it was really just, it's a fascinating long story. But yes, that was his beginning. And then because, you know, I mean, he had to maintain his credibility as a serious, he was a psychiatrist, which he later said he was a recovering.
Kind of like a recovering banker, right?
Right. He really did go public with the Bendeloff story for many, many years. It was quite recent. I would say maybe 10 or so years ago.
Wow, I would love to see that.
Yeah, but I can certainly send that to you, along with his website.
Well, you know, let's stay, Judy, on the subject of the paranormal for a while, because as my audience knows, and yours as well, I'm sure your readers know, it's one of our favorite subjects because it's so much more than we think it is. It's definitely not novelty, and I think it's indicative of really the true nature of reality. But I want to really kind of get into that as far as dreams are concerned. I mean, let's talk about life after death, the afterlife, or what we refer to in academia as the survival of consciousness theory.
Mm-hmm.
How might dreams become a working laboratory or landscape that might show empirical evidence of life after death? Is there anything we can deduce from the dreamscape beside personal anecdotal evidence that this is a reality, life after death?
Well, I mean, would you include anecdotal evidence with
that? I guess we'd have to. But I guess what I'm saying is, because, I mean, there's so many different examples of intimations of immortality, right?
Mm-hmm.
That are experienced not only in the dreamscape, but in waking time. But the dreams seem to be this access point to, it's another landscape. What, I don't know if I'm making it clear or not, but what about dreams might give us even more intimations of immortality? I don't know how
else
to say.
Well, you know, when somebody comes into a dream, that is no longer on this plane.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a message to leave. And then later the dreamer finds that whatever they were told has indeed manifested. There you have it. But then, of course, you know, the skeptics would say, well, you know, that was like selective attention and that's how you made it. So, you know, it's back to what we were talking about before is proof. It's very hard. I mean, are we talking about specific people, or are we talking about any type of paranormal activity?
Well, in this case, I'm talking about
people.
Well, in this case, I'm talking about the paranormal activity being support for the survival of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Well, I mean, I think it's all there. I think that, you know, there in my dreams, you know, there are many symbols that I associated with people who had passed over,
mm-hmm.
spirits. And they were like earthly markers in the dreams, like a favorite color or a song, a movie, a book, you know, that sort of thing, a joke.
Mm-hmm.
So you know that the communication is taking place. And I think, you know, not to overdo it with lavender, but so much of that communication was pointing to real physical evidence of the information that I was receiving.
Sure.
I mean, that's right there. I mean, it's, if you go to the back where the index is, you know, you'll see, and there are two appendices, and one is synchronous experiences, and the other is, I think, electronic anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have that communication, which is then later borne out into something that physically manifests And I think that is probably a starting point.
Okay.
I had a such an involved. Had a dream where I was in Vancouver Island, and I happened to pass a porch, and sitting on this porch was a lavender or a purple chair, and on the chair were about five different elements of things I had dreamt over the years, all collected on this one chair, on this porch, on this very in this very remote location.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all of those elements had been coming to me through spirit, but there they were. You know, this is very much along the lines of Rupert Sheldrake's morphogenetic field.
Sure. Yeah.
Is that they have memory? So I think there's different ways of looking at it. I don't think it's like anything that is direct, but I do think that there will be more scientific exploration as to how this past life consciousness manifests, and it does very much so in dreams, as you know.
I
don't think I'm giving you the answer that you're looking for.
Oh, no. I don't know that there is even an answer per se. I just kind of wanted to get your thought about it. It's still a very elusive phenomenon.
I mean, there is something about this, the afterlife communication, is that from my own experience and that of others, because, you know, I do presentations and workshops, whenever there is unfamiliar surroundings, there was sort of a feeling of otherworldliness. That scenario can incorporate interconnecting hallways, rooms with vast spaces, mansions, big halls, open air markets, people en masse. That's a major one. All together. So there are no borders and there are no boundaries. And we don't have that in this dimension.
Right. So you're saying that those are hallmarks of that sort of otherworldliness, these big open air spaces are hallmarks that we're what? That we're
of being in the afterlife.
Of being in the
And then very often then there are in my dreams in particular, very often in that particular scenario, there is always the presence of someone who has passed over.
Yeah. That is very curious to me. I'm thinking of some dreams that I've had that include some of those elements.
So that's familiar to you?
Yes.
Great.
Yes, it's very familiar to me. As a matter of fact, I also wanted to bring up, I mean, we could stay on this forever, is having sort of, let me see if I can explain this, Judy. I have had quite a few dreams over the course of my life where I was doing psychokinetic things, levitation, seeing ghosts manifest as the people that they used to be in the dream state. I have had several dreams of being with my mother, who's been deceased almost 20 years, where I was actually showing her that I was able to levitate myself onto the ceiling. So these paranormal abilities are almost effortless and very in my face in many of my dreams. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yes, it absolutely does, because you have made that transition to a transpersonal, that's what we started talking about, to a person. You've gone from your personal, that's the bidirectionality, you've gone from your personal realm into a transpersonal realm where all of that is possible. And the beauty of that, I think, is the feeling of interconnectedness. I mean, I don't know if you've had that. Have you had, I mean, is that what you've experienced? That there's like an immediacy to connection that wipes out the fear of death, of being separated.
I wouldn't say it wipes out the fear, but I think I understand what you're saying.
I mean, do you feel connected in those kinds of dreams?
Connected to
your mother? Or...
Yes, of course. Well, I dream of both my parents are gone, and I dream of them constantly, but it's almost like I'm spending time with them, and it's relieved my missing them to the extent that I might have. They're just sort of enfolded in my life in the dreamscape.
Well, that's so beautiful, because, I mean, they are still in your life.
They're still in my life. I have no doubt about that.
You know, they're not, when you come back to here and you wake up, their physical presence isn't visible. But that was one thing, I'm sort of branching off here, but that was one thing that I learned through the whole study of vision, is the ability to see the visible, that was the convergent vision, mm-hmm. the ability to see the visible and the invisible.
Right, to see the invisible.
And that's right. What we do,
yeah.
We dream.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Hey, this is one thing I hadn't planned on asking, but you just said something a little while ago that kind of reminded me. We're talking about really kind of traversing two or more worlds, the dreamscape and then the waking state, and I find them there. Again, there's a link. There's no separation, really. It's maybe just a shift of focus. I know you have probably heard of, and there's probably a name that I'm not going to use properly, but the phenomenon where people, Judy, will have a dream that they are being attacked in some way or being scratched or getting into a fight, and they will wake up with the physical markings on their body.
Mm-hmm.
I just talked to a woman, someone that I happen to know not so long ago, who told me the story of her having a dream of being chased by a snake, and she was bitten on her arm in the dream. And she woke up and she looked on her arm and she saw what looked to be a snake bite on her arm.
Mm, 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 mm.
What's that all about? Are you?
Well, I think it's all, well, you know, I mean, as I'm listening to you and thinking of the experience I had, I think it's all energy.
It's all energy.
And energy can work in, you know, just the most incredible ways. It's so mysterious. But I think that, you know, if we are taking that fear into our psyche and letting it sort of rest where it should be actually expelled.
Right.
Through healing modalities and such. I think we are very capable of creating those situations for ourselves.
And bringing them onto the physical plane, literally.
Bringing them onto the physical plane, because it is all, I really have a very strong belief that it is all energetic.
It's all energetic. That's interesting. Interesting.
That it can manifest as a real thing.
We create our own reality. I guess that's taking
exactly.
Seth's
concept. I mean, it's what you are looking for is what you're going to find.
What you're looking for is what you're going to find. We've heard that in so many different contexts. I mean, from
yes.
The Secret, you know, you can manifest your dreams to some of the most elusive and academic data, like what we're touching on today. But again, the theme is the same. You know, the work of the great work of Seth and the Jane Roberts, of course,
yes.
I absolutely loved reading many years ago. YCYOR, you create your own reality, individually and en masse. You know, whether you're aware of it or not, it's just the way it works, whether you're wreaking havoc or creating havoc or creating what your dream.
It's just so fascinating. I just happened to come across a fascinating piece on DNA and what they're doing as in terms of light and how it is now, you know, I mean, it's still, you know, experimental, but that it is actually communicating with light.
Mm-hmm.
And, if we have reached a time where this is happening, then I think that it's entirely possible for, you know, all of the a physical manifestation is coming from, like a snake bite, is coming from a very, very, very deep place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless there was a snake in the bed with her.
There was no snake in the bed that she... Oh, God.
That would be...
Right, that would be pretty creepy too.
Well,
but no, and I've heard this before, Judy. I have heard this before, and it has always fascinated me. There is some link between the visible and the invisible. And in fact, the spiritual and the scientific, I don't care. There really is no opposites. They're just different forms of the same fundamental thing, which is energy.
Yeah, well, it's manifestation. It's the same as me seeing a bunch of objects on a chair, as a person who is experiencing a dream about a snake bite and then waking up with a snake bite.
Yeah.
You know, I was working with someone who was a what is it for when their discipline is in sex? What is the
I can't call it.
Yeah, I'm blanking on this, but
it begins with an A, I think. And anyway, yeah, we know what you're talking about.
And so here, you know, I had been deeply involved in something we were working on, and we were on the phone, and I hung up, and I went into my bathroom, and there was the biggest roach I have ever seen.
Oh my goodness.
It was like an animal. The thing was so huge. Now, I've lived in this apartment for over 20 years. I've never seen anything like that.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Were you emotionally immersed in the...
Yes.
See?
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Well, there it is.
So, you know, I mean, it's good to have, you know, such an immediate manifestation.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't even look like an insect anymore, but it was.
It was an elephant.
I mean, it was so big.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, you talk about immediate manifestation, and you have to wonder all that's going on right now. I touch on this in my book as well. Is the veil lifting? If the frequency is increasing, things like manifestation through thought and feeling and fear can happen even quicker these days.
Yes. Fear, you know, that is really, I think we're at a time now where we must first, that there is a wonderful environmentalist by the name of Paul Hawken.
Mm-hmm.
And he has done a very short video, 2 minutes, on, I think it's titled, Is Climate Change Happening to Us or for Us? His premise is that, you know, we can go on being the victims, and we can go on blaming government and politics and all of the things that we blame on this having happened. But we contributed to it. And his feeling is that nothing will be the same. That climate change is a transformation that transforms everything. So nothing will be the same except for, you know, like really deeply held human values and sensibilities that come from just from being alive. And he is saying, and I would agree with this, that we really need to begin the dialogue to talk with each other.
Yeah.
To connect. Even though we may be poles apart, just to respect each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I like to say, it's or welcome, egos are not.
That's right. That's right. I love that. It's or welcome. Death of the ego, rest in peace.
Yeah. I mean, because the more of this that we stir up, the more there's going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just got to be an end.
Right.
And, you know, when you start thinking about the news and the CO2 emissions and the latest UN report, you know, it's time. And I was so interested in your piece, your YouTube piece, because I mean, it was just really speaking to what is this is now the time.
Yeah, urgent now.
We can't, your sense of immediacy and urgency really spoke to me.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of us are feeling it, Judy. You know, some of us, there are many of us that aren't in this line of work, and I don't know that you even need to be to know. You feel there's that inner sense of urgency. And my whole book is based on taking the time to get off the hamster wheel, get out of reactive mode, and get into reflection mode. And once you do, you're going to feel that sense of urgency as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, I see this happening. You know, I have some friends who are not involved in what we are.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all feeling it.
Yeah.
And they're all questioning, you know, why they're feeling so poorly. Some of them can't even identify what it is.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. Yeah.
So, you know, it's really time for us to come together. And the urgency, you know, whether we want to accept it or not, it is going to continue.
It's going to continue. And it's going to continue until we acknowledge it and just decide to do something about it. And, you know, in wrapping up, you bring this out in your book, yes? I mean, some of these dreams were very much pointing out the urgency, right?
Yeah.
Tell us, let's end on that note. I think that's a poignant note to end on. What were these dreams saying? And how was it expressed?
Well, the way it was coming, I can just give you a few examples because, I mean, the bottom line was that there is an alchemical, I mean, this is after many, many years, it's a lot of research, a lot of connecting the dots, but the bottom line is that there is an alchemical transmutation occurring within the earth. And, you know, it's a lot of chemistry involved in this, but it's basically that sulfur is producing more sulfur,
mm-hmm.
and it's the way it's interacting with radioactive decay. And it's within the earth. I mean, I have some specific places, but I think that the places that I was pointed to were really prototypes, considering, you know, the overall work. And here's an example, or a few examples of warnings I got. Here's one from
mm-hmm.
1999.
Mm-hmm.
People are jammed together in a very crowded house. A lit cigarette is burning deep in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one. They have a little cluster of burning dreams. Another one where it's a lit cigarette is burning in a rug.
Mm-hmm.
It's the earth. There's another one from 2000. Earthquake sites are great resources for junk. And junk, for me, after a lot of work, represented nuclear waste and nuclear dump sites. And I'll give you one last one. There was a mother figure who was driving around something circular. There were metal plates on the ground, and the car slips and goes over the edge, so she goes underwater. We are falling. I'm thinking, how can we pull ourselves back up to the top? I feel we can make it, but don't know how. So the car represented the tectonic engine, which was driving Mother Earth, and that her slipping and going over the edge was perhaps of the result of a strike-slip fault where plates fly past one another.
Wow.
So if you just took that by itself, you could say, well, you know, I have this problem with my mother, and you could say, you know, I was like worried. But this was, I can tell you, in all honesty, this was like the result of so many, 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 many dreams
mm-hmm.
that you conveyed basically the same message.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of a dream that I had. I can't give it in that much detail. I don't know that I wrote it down. I may have, but it had a similar tone. Water, a car, a flood, driving into waves, driven by a deceased aunt with me. And
ooh.
Yeah, who never drove, by the way.
Oh, there you go.
Who never drove.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you know when that was? Not that.
When I had the dream?
Yeah.
Mm.
The recent? Was it?
Within 2 years, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Within 2 years.
Well, more and more people are having those dreams.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the cause. That's the collective.
Yeah. Well, we're ending kind of on a critical and urgent note, but I think it's important that we, you know, dreams are designed to support us. They are what I like to say, we mine, if we mine, like we're mining gold, mine our dreams, we can get answers. It's going to take some work. It's going to take some digging, like Judy Gardner has done so beautifully. But I think we're designed to do that. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having these dreams. So we can dream of the urgency, but we can also dream of a future of positivity as long as we can take action on those dreams. So Judy Gardner, thank you so much for for this incredible book called Lavender. I want people to go to your website, cosmicdreaming.com. We'll have that linked up below so you can go and check out and learn how to start decoding your dreams. But again, Judy, thank you so much for your time and for your wisdom.
Well, it was wonderful, and I do want to say that we are really heading toward enlightenment if we will allow that to happen. I really believe that.
That's great. It's there for us. And with people like you, we'll get there. I know
we will. We have to.
Yeah. Thanks, Judy.
Thank you so much, Alexis.
From synchronicities to archetypes, electronic anomalies to real ghostwriters, Judy's book Lavender reveals the magic and mystery of both science and spirituality, and how, at the core, the two are really different approaches to understanding the fundamental dance of the universe. Lavender is complex and revealing, a breathtaking and unusual approach to cosmic consciousness. You can learn more about Lavender and the work of Judy Gardner by visiting the link below. I thank you, as always, for listening to Conscious Inquiry. Until next time, I'm Alexis Brooks.